We have action item 7.3.1 is some naming opportunities. Mr. Hiles.
Yes, I would just comment that this is a routine that we do on a regular basis to bring naming opportunities to the board for your consideration and approval. It's something we put in place about 6 or 7 years ago. I'd be more than glad to answer any of the questions. We did talk about the Orbison gift, which is the largest of the gifts on this list at $500,000. And the rest, a number of them include the publications building, which are now underway. And again, I want to compliment the journalism staff, our fundraising staff, and others. It was really a grassroots effort there. And you see a number of commitments that really resulted in sacrificial gifts on the part of those donors. So that was a piece of it. The CEC is an ongoing interest for the community, and those were gifts committed some time ago, but again, bringing them to you on a quarterly basis. And then again, the Gatton Academy with a couple of corporate commitments for naming opportunities. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer that, but Madam Chair, we're seeking a motion to approve these naming opportunities.
All right.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay. Next item is authorizing purchase. John, I think we need you here to address some property.
Madam Chair, I think we need a quick letter to divide in the item for that. It's here today. As you know, we're in the process. And at the 10, 3 weeks ago, we prepared the agenda item. We were still engaged in discussions with one of the property owners. And subsequent to mailing you the agenda item, we did reach agreement, but the amount needed to be adjusted slightly more in order to reach agreement, but still within the confines of our acceptable procedures. So what I'd like to first do is let you know that, yes, there is a revised agenda item. The only difference between the two is the purchase price on one of the properties. I would draw your attention to the map and the diagrams that are on pages 47, 48, and 49. I mentioned to you yesterday when we were discussing our capital construction that this area is slated to receive a construction of a parking lot expansion to the University Boulevard parking lot utilizing $4 million in agency bonds that will be for parking and transportation and property acquisition improvements. This is one project of several we will conduct with this $4 million agency bond. And as illustrated on the map, you see on page 48, for example, that there is a parking lot on University Boulevard, and next to it are the colored properties on the map that will be included in this action. And the revised, the revised agenda item outlines for you the cost of the property to make that possible.
Did you, John, excuse me if I missed it, the source of funds for this is the $4 million agency bond that the board has approved that is for a campus parking, and this is one of the projects in that initiative. So off-property acquisitions to this and another action item on here are part of that $4 million parking bond that's to be sold this fall. So this is not a reserve fund or any other source of funds. It's all within the cost of those parking initiatives.
Move approval of the acquisition.
Second, please.
Second.
Questions, comments?
Question, John. These three properties, are we giving $686,000?
Yes, sir.
That's $200,000+. $200,000+ per house. You got appraisals on all those, I guess?
Yes, sir. It turns out that at 1770, for example, the appraisal on that house is done as far back in 2003 because of the Tennessee Real Estate Foundation acquired the property in 2003, and they have held it for us in that period of time.
Well, that
property. And so what we're buying it is at an amount less than the appraisal that was conducted in November of 2003. So we are only paying the payoff amount on the remaining balance that the foundation has. Is an illustration.
The foundation on the house?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Right. So in the case of these acquisitions, two of these are from the Debt Keegan Foundation.
Okay.
At the balance on the mortgage after they have been reduced since they were acquired in 2003.
And the foundation has been cash flowing
with
renting the properties, so that they obviously, if we want to buy it, and then we have to pay the mortgage off so that they're
Break
even. Yeah. It's the real estate foundation.
Yeah.
Car too, John?
No.
But I'm real straight right today. You might be able to buy it cheaper than you could have in 2003, but since we already own them, it didn't make any difference.
That's correct. I mean, WKU Real Estate Foundation, this is an example of something that has really worked well for us. They came on the market at a time when we didn't really need nor want to put them into use, but we knew that according to the campus master plan, they were in an area that needed to be acquired. So we found Real Estate Foundation, acquired the property, got a mortgage on the property, managed the property, and put the rent from what it generated towards the mortgage. We made up the difference in the meantime, which is, in many cases, not a lot of money. But the win here is that we took it off the market at the rate it was then, and we let them hold it until now. And then, foundation at the balance they owe on property. So when we need it, and when we need to put it to good use.
So there's only one house there you're buying from an individual.
That's correct. It's a tab, that is a privately held house, but owner occupied. And so it has not been on the market. I needed to go approach those folks, and just this morning, an hour ago, reached agreement, which is reflected in the documents.
What's the intended use for the properties, immediately or long term?
The intended use is outlined for you on page 49, as we discussed yesterday. In other words, those properties will be raised, and there will be a parking lot expansion that will be put onto that site. The map on page 48 gives you the best illustration of where they are in relationship to the existing parking lot. You can see that lot will be extended, utilizing everything that's colored, over to Normal. That will be properties. Two of them will be raised this fall. The third, which is owner-occupied, we are acquiring now, but we're going to go back to the owner. Let them have a year to relocate. We will raise that property next summer, and then incorporate that property into it next summer. So this will be a phased project that will result in that expansion.
There are some beautiful mature trees on those lots, and I don't know if you can tell on this schematic on page 49, but we will try to preserve as many of those mature trees within the construction of that lot as possible to sustain that environmental priority.
Is the intent to acquire 1790 and 1780?
1790 is currently owned by the university.
Oh, okay.
And it is used by the university. And we think that given its size and location and condition, that it does not justify its removal in order to fit into the plans. Taking it down doesn't give us that much gain. So our plan is to leave that property and utilize it on an ongoing basis. The house next to it at 1780 is the one also I mentioned to you yesterday. It is held in trust by the Real Estate Foundation, and our plan is to lease it from the trust for the remaining term of the trust, which I believe is about 10 years. Tom, is that your recollection?
Yes.
So we will make payments to the trust in the form of a lease for 10 years, at which time the lease arrangement will allow that property to be transferred to the university. While it's under lease to us, we will raise the property
raise the structure on the property.
But it is included in the parking lot. This on page 49, it will become part of the parking area.
Not easy to see on page 49, but The significance of all this is illustrated in an overlay there where the houses, parking lot, or something.
How far down normal are you going to go?
That will be it on that block.
Okay. And I'm glad to hear that, by the way, as a proud resident of the College Heights Historic District. I have a theoretical issue and a practical issue with this idea. But I can't really express my theoretical point any better than President Ransdell did yesterday when we were talking about our wonderful new LEED building that is going to go in as a replacement for Tate Page. And you said, don't tell them they're building a parking lot down the street. That's right. That's right. If we're going to walk it or talk it, let's walk it. I don't like blacktopping areas for, you know, flat one-space use without some kind of space-efficient parking structure. My observation and experience after 14 years on this campus is that parking is one of those, if you build it, they will come. There is an infinite demand for parking. We can blacktop the whole thing all the way to Fountain Square, and it's never going to be satisfied. And we have to come up with different and smarter solutions, and taking out houses that could be used for other things, for academic purposes, for student services purposes, for visiting scholars purposes, any other purpose than taking it down, putting blacktop in, and doing something different than the environmental stewardship that we're trying to promote through the shuttle, through bike racks, through encouraging people not to buy their car. Universities lead, and I don't think this is leadership. I think this is a bad idea for all of the theoretical reasons above. The pragmatic reason is I thought this board a few years ago, prior to my joining it, I thought the board was told we were going to renovate the central parking structure, which, while an eyesore, does provide a purpose, and it's already there, so why not do something more in the space that we have and preserve the beauty of our campus and other places?
Well, we did renovate parking structure 1, the original parking structure, and then built parking structure 2, so we did do that. But renovating the parking structure 1 didn't give us any net new space. It just extended the life of a...
Well, it was restriped and we gained almost 200 places.
Reconfigured. But we did renovate. Now, there will be ongoing work on parking structure 1 over time because it was built in 1970-ish. I don't remember the exact year, John, but it is pushing 40 years old. But we did put a few million dollars into parking structure 1. But you know, I understand the point, Patty, and the only way I can respond is it's a balance. We have to be environmentally thoughtful. We do have to lead by example, but that's not an absolute. And there are other factors that we have to accommodate. And we are losing some spaces with the College of Education Behavioral Sciences building. We are going to, with the $4 million bond, there are four projects. Building the Kentucky Street lot that's now gravel. Renovating the Pierce Ford Tower lot, which needs a better, more efficient use. We can gain some spaces by regrading that and then repaving and striping it and better lighting and so forth, but we can gain some net spaces. The Chestnut Street lot behind Thompson Complex North Wing is very inefficient lot, but it can be graded and rebuilt. It has no substructure under it, and it may as well be parking on gravel. And then this lot. So the net gain will be a significant number of spaces, but the environmental improvements to those lots and the stormwater runoff improvements and a lot of factors come into play in this $4 million parking bond issue for these four lots. And I agree with you. it's tough to use these particular houses for visiting faculty because the foundation has a business plan. They're paying the lease. I mean, they have to rent them. They cannot allow them for university use unless the university pays the mortgage on it.
Yeah, unless we buy it and then we can do anything we want.
Unless we buy it and then we can do anything we want. And right now, we're trying to really be thoughtful on our reserve fund because our reserve fund took a pretty big hit in the budget reduction. This does not call our reserve fund into play for these transactions. So I agree with you 100%, except for the fact that we're trying to do both. We're trying to be environmentally responsible, which I think we are in many ways. On the other hand, the realities of automobiles, even if they're smaller automobiles in the future, parking is still going to be an issue that we've got to address. And so there's no debating the point you're making.
It will ultimately, if we follow the demand curve, which I've decided is absolutely infinite, we would have to destroy our aesthetically pleasing campus to do it. I don't think anybody wants to do it. We're not going to do that. Right, we're not. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
And I don't think this project, I'm anxious to see what trees we're saving. I'm anxious to see what the design's going to be formally. We will do the very best we can. We've made some mistakes with some of the parking lots we built. The Creason lot between the corner of University Boulevard and by the railroad trestle that goes between the campus, between Keene Hall and the softball field. I wish I'd have known then what I know now, but I mean, that's just nothing but blacktop. We should have sustained an environmentally responsible priority when that was built. That one won't happen again. And in fact, we may come back sometime and take up a few spaces and put in some trees within that lot just to absorb some of the environmental problem. Now, we have solved the stormwater problems in that lot, but the home battery, we're on a hill. We do have stormwater runoff problems, and all of these lots have to accommodate control of water runoff to neighborhoods and streets that surround us. That's a part of all four of these lots and the construction of these lots, frankly, and the lot we're building right now at the north end of the campus between Van Meter and the new 14th Street. The cost of that lot almost doubled because of environmental stewardship on our part to control stormwater runoff from that lot. So you're right. I can't debate that. On the other hand, there are a lot of different needs we've got to address and achieve and try to do so in as responsible manner as we can. So.
You're talking about environmentally responsible parking lots. Have you considered any of those alternative to black tops to parking lots now? I know there's one that's like a plastic grid and it lets the water go through, but you don't have to bend to the storm. What about the water runoff? I don't know how expensive they are if they're feasible.
We have some of that in place now, but it's principally used in areas where it's not driven on and parked on a daily basis, but rather it's an occasional use or periodic use. Mm-hmm. So we have several areas of the campus where that is in place now near some residence halls and so forth. But that's not an application for something that's used every day and parked on every day, which is what we expect to be here.
And our problem is the fact that the hill, we have such volume when we do have a storm, and these lots are all on the periphery of the campus, and that's where the water runs. And if we're going to control what goes down the streets and into the neighborhoods that surround us, these lots have to be designed and built in a way that we prevent the significant runoff when storms occur. That's the primary thing. And a lot like you're describing is good in two cases, if it's not used every day by hundreds of cars, but on a more infrequent basis. And secondly, if your water runoff is modest. But if it comes with a storm, what you're describing isn't going to capture what you need to capture. So The answer is yes, but it kind of depends on location and use.
And the more environmentally responsible you are, the more space you have to have.
Correct. No, exactly. Yeah.
I would add, too, that we have a campus master plan that indicates that parking and any growth in the university into the community would be used to put parking on the perimeter. That I want to remind you that the main campus, we are focusing on trying to make it pedestrian friendly and removing vehicles wherever we can. If you go back just a few years and start looking at everything that's been occurring in simplistic terms, what we've been doing is moving cars off the campus wherever we can, or putting it on the perimeter of the campus and making the primary campus itself as pedestrian friendly as possible.
We can't be a green campus in our campus core without moving it to the periphery. And we just can't assume that the cars won't, a certain level of vehicles won't be in our midst every day. We only have 5,000 beds on campus. We have 14 to 15,000 students on the main campus daily. I hope many of them start riding bicycles, but
riding the shuttle. I mean, that's the future. The shuttle is the future, and that's how the beautiful campuses of this country solve this problem. They don't stick it right on the periphery. They go out to the outer circle, so that the entire periphery remains beautiful, aesthetically pleasing, and environmentally conscious.
Well, we're doing that. We have satellite lots. We're entering a lease with downtown and the parking structure, 300 spaces.
Yeah.
200 initially, and then another 100 after 15 years, I think, in the downtown parking garage. So the reality is yes to all the above.
And wherever you put the parking, it's environmentally going to be the same problem. It's just aesthetically, it may be more pleasing here. But you got the same blacktop.
And going vertical is now costing 15,000 space. So, PS1, by the way, cannot be added to. PS1, when it was built in the 70s, after further complete analysis, determined you cannot expand that one going vertical. It only expanded horizontally. We were looking at, years ago, expanding it over the street. But that's what caused the cost to go up, and that's when the analysis was made. We are better off building what we now call PS2, where it sits.
John, what's the projected life of that building?
The original parking structure.
PS1 was the...
What's the projected
1,000 cars in it.
Oh, projected life.
Oh, mercy. We have extended projected life a few years than what we've done. If we spend another right at $1.5 million in just deferred capital renewal and deferred maintenance in the building, we can gain another 20 years.
Okay, my good.
So, but it was built in 74 or 5, something like that. So it's... It is definitely at a point where we got to continue to reinvest in it. The good news is we've had structural engineers in there. It's been fully evaluated. Several things have been done that it needed, but it still needs ongoing work. I mean, these concrete structures, they look sound and sturdy, but you've got to work on them.
Take a lot of wear and tear. I mean, it just looks like a concrete structure, but there's a lot of wear and tear in that on a daily basis.
You have the motion on the new paper because there was a change in the cost. The motion is in order at this time.
I thought we moved already.
We did?
Yeah, we did.
I'm sorry, the discussion lasted longer than I, in my memory. So you have a motion and a second, is that correct, Madam Secretary? All right. All in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign.
No.
Okay. Indicate that there was a no, please.
And I abstain.
All right, thank you. All right. John, we're at...
The reason we have created two agenda items for property is that these involve two different lots.
Okay.
On the total opposite end of the university's campus, at the far, what I might call, northeastern corner of the campus, which is again illustrated on page 52 in your agenda. If you're familiar with the area, it is a gravel lot that is between the streets of Adams Street, 14th in this case, and Kentucky Street. And we are proposing with the $4 million bond, of course, to convert that gravel lot into permanent parking as part of the $4 million project. There is one particular property still remaining on the corner of 14th and Kentucky. We have reached agreement with that owner. The property's on a contract, and as outlined in the agenda item, with your approval, we can close on that property. And once again, that same situation will come true. We cannot start construction on this property now, because it would be under construction at a time when we need it the most, which is a false message. So your proposal today would allow us to purchase the property, close on it, and work with the owner to have him relocate next year in a way that works for us as the developer. We would take occupancy of the property next May, start construction in May, and get as much of it completed during the summer months as we could, if not all of it, if possible, during summer months, and be ready for the fall semester of 09.
This motion is on page 50.
That's correct.
And this is to approve and authorize the purchase of 1401 Kentucky Street, Bowling Green, Warren County, Kentucky, for the sum of $137,500.
That's correct.
Move the authorization to purchase 1401 Kentucky Street.
Second.
All right. Is there other questions, comments? Is there?
Yeah. I want to go back to the environmental discussion, because that's probably been among the most frustrating things with the vetoes in 2006. This was a project that should have been done a couple of years ago. We approved it. It was authorized. We had the debt capacity for the project. And with that veto, we've had gravel lots that have been at the opposite end of the environmental responsibility spectrum. I won't overstate it and say disastrous, but it has really been problematic in stormwater runoff from a gravel lot down Kentucky and Adams Street, where the hill goes the opposite direction, and. That's been a frustrating thing that's just had to sit there, and it's been inconvenient for our students. The lots that big to park on gravel, it's just the dust and the challenge of navigating the shoes. So it'll be good to finally get these lots done, but that will be what will end up being almost a 3-year delay. Getting these lots done following that veto in the spring of 06.
Was this delay have anything to do with the price of the house? Was it agreed upon, the purchase price agreed upon earlier, or is it one that has been agreed upon since it's been a buyer's market?
Well, both. Mm-hmm. I've been talking to this gentleman, quite frankly, for probably 2-3 years. This one house has been sitting there for a very long time, and it took this price for us to reach agreement.
Is there any other houses close by that you got to have for that one, or is that the last one?
In this particular construction site for this lot, this is the last one for this lot.
That's on that corner.
Because at 137 on that one, the next one, I mean, they go, oh boy, I mean, they'll start holding us up pretty good, because that's not a very good piece of property.
No, it's not. And frankly, we kind of waited until the project was approved in the General Assembly and authorized, and we knew when we were going to proceed, because we kind of needed that leverage with the buyer that we're going forward.
One way
and
another, yeah.
And we are cautious, if not loath, to exercise it, but eminent domain was our next alternative. But that wasn't a card we could play until we knew the project was authorized by the General Assembly and we were proceeding with the parking lot. And that wasn't assured until this past legislative session this last spring. So the holding pattern of the property, the lot, the environmental concerns of gravel and all that is just we're going to be glad to finally get this one in the books.
And that guy would be glad to get it sold.
And I can put this one in a slightly different category. I still don't love more blacktop, but It's already done. This whole area has already been, as you point out, it's put in a gravel parking lot. You're also in a completely different category in this neighborhood, because you're also, once you start looking south of 14th Street, now you're starting to get into the
TIF.
Right, the TIF, exactly. So this is an area that's going to become something totally different anyway, and a better gateway. But I'll repeat the point. It's, we have to think about our gateways, and parking on the periphery is still not a solution. We're just going to have to re-educate people and get them to do other things, or we just become surrounded in a sea of ugly blacktop with some nice trees.
Any other comment, or are they ready for the question?
I just have one quick question. But since this is in the gravel stage, and when it's all said and done, you could still add, like, trees or whatever to kind of spruce up the parking lot?
It'll be included in the design. Yeah.
Good.
Yesterday, when I put that lot up on the projector for you, mm-hmm. it had a preliminary design that showed how we would configure that area, and that was just a preliminary outlay so that you saw what the area would be converted to. But certainly, we will use a landscape architect on our staff, as well as a landscape architect will be a part of the design team, yeah. and we will follow some established guidelines and standards for how we use plant material on the site.
As John will tell you, I am personally the chief of the tree police. I got to sign any tree that's removed. I personally must approve that, and there's not a week goes by that I'm not pressing to put trees in somewhere.
Hearing no more comments, all in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye. Indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Same sign. Motion passes. John, you're on this. No, I think you take your rest, right?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We have a motion before us and a recommendation for an addendum to number one of the second amended athletic employment contract between Western Kentucky University and Mary Taylor Cowles. So the motion is approval addendum number one, the second amended athletic employment contract between Western Kentucky University and Mary Taylor Cowles. I'll entertain that motion.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. Are there questions or comments?
I have a question. It says this is dependent on whether or not there's sufficient revenues available in the Women's Basketball Enhancement Fund. What determines what funds go into that?
The Women's Basketball Enhancement Fund is a private fund that's generated through private donations. And each program has an enhancement fund, some bigger than others. Women's basketball is blessed with a very sizable enhancement fund.
It's not dependent on what the basketball team...
It's dependent on the generosity of the donors. We solicit annually for the enhancement fund outside of gifts to the Hilltopper Athletic Foundation. So it's specific revenues that are dedicated to individual programs, and they are used with the authorization by myself and the head coach. So it falls under the NCAA compliance issues.
And if she achieves all these goals and we don't reward her, we won't have her.
True, but this is also an incentive for her to be part of building that enhancement.
Absolutely.
right.
Yes. She's going to make sure the money comes in.
As a matter of fact, Mary's helped us. We're on our way to our ninth endowed women's basketball scholarship. No other program at WKU has as many endowed scholarships, and Mary's been really, really responsible for most of that effort that we've had success with to endow our women's basketball program. So that's part of the enhancement effort that we make for each individual program. Just so you all know, already in place with Mary Taylor Cowles and her current contract are most of all these bonus items except for number two under C. C2, advanced to the round of 32, and C4. In other words, her current contract calls for everything on this amended contract except for items number C2 and C4. We have just added those two items because, one, it's consistent with what we have with our men's coach, and two, we felt that every time you advance a round in the NCAA tournament,
It's consistent with what many coaches around the country are earning and receiving, and it's a way we can reward our coaches consistent with what other coaches around the country are receiving. And again, speaking to continuity, we want to make sure we maintain continuity of our coaching staff, and I feel like we can best do that by providing incentive and rewards that are consistent with those around the country. So really, the tweak is only adding advance to the round of 32 as a one-month salary bonus and advance to the round of 8, one-month salary bonus. Everything else is already in place in the current contract.
What's the difference between the one-month salary bonus and why do we add monetary value on the last two instead of the one-month salary bonus?
Coach of the Year, yeah, Mary's been three-time Coach of the Year in the last 6 years. That's standard with some of our coaching contracts. It's not a month value. It is a flat amount for Coach of the Year. The league championship, we define that a little bit more in detail on this amendment. The league championship, you can win the league outright during the regular season. And if you don't win the tournament carries the automatic bid. So in other words, we could have a team that has great success during the regular season, wins the conference championship outright in the regular season, stumbles in the tournament, does not get the automatic bid. When we get the automatic bid, it's an NCAA tournament bid, which carries 1 month's salary. We could do great things all year, not win the tournament, not go to the NCAA, even though we won our league championship regular season, and it would be very disappointing. But to pick that up, there's a $4,000 bonus for having the success that's harder to sustain all year long than sometimes it is on a three-day run through a tournament. So that's why we've added that caveat of the $4,000. We've really defined it. We haven't really added that to this amendment. We've come out and defined more what the league championship is and how that is defined. Winning it outright, not a tie.
Mm-hmm.
You said that the enhancement fund for all of sports is not through HAF. Who are the stewards of that fund since it's private money?
Right. It's with WKU Foundation.
Okay.
Did you say this is common that schools do this? I'm just wondering if she's out raising money that then she will get. Is she going to run into enormous problems?
She's not out on her own raising money. She'll be with a development officer going with them to make a presentation.
She's still getting the benefit of the money she's helping raise.
Well,
I know there's the achievement element in there too, but I'm just...
Right. Our most effective fundraisers are our coaches.
Yeah.
They're able to make the most compelling case of need to our donors. So we generally have the best success when we involve one of our coaches in our solicitations with donors.
And I would say the preponderance of that money, of course, is not for salaries, but for recruiting trips or enhancements in other ways.
The non-endowed scholarships all support the budget for scholarships. Not this. This is only a part. You raise an interesting point, but we often involve the faculty who would be the beneficiary of an endowed professorship or endowed chair in the closing of a gift with the prospective donor for that, and that's the best salesmanship there is when the donor comes to know the intellectual and scholarly value of the beneficiary. Obviously, that individual will only be in that endowed position a portion of the time. Because it goes on in perpetuity. But still, people make investments based on their confidence in what will become of it. And that comes down to people.
We had an individual who made a $100,000 contribution to endow a women's basketball scholarship about two years ago. And he had never been to a women's basketball game in his life. But he knew Mary Taylor Cowles, he knew the type of individual that she was, and he wanted to support her program. So without ever going to a women's basketball game, he made a $100,000 contribution to support women's basketball.
Now we get him there from time to time.
Madam Chair, ask the general counsel, does this contract, like most of the athletic contracts I've reviewed, contain a binding arbitration clause?
Mm-hmm.
Then when you take your vote, I'm going to ask for a point of order to explain my vote.
Are we ready for the...
One question. Is this consistent, the fact that the bonus is tied to the available funding? Is that consistent with the men's contract as well?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
One difference is if a men's coach advances in the NCAA tournament, there is revenue distribution in the Sun Belt Conference that inures to our benefit that helps pay this bonus as well, whereas a women's team that advances in the NCAA tournament, you don't get the kind of money in the women's tournament that men's teams get because of the difference in the TV contracts with the NCAA and CBS. So not to get overly complex on it, but there is much more revenue at stake when the men's team advances for our program, and this last year is a great example. Those three games in the NCAA tournament netted us over $400,000 for the athletic budget through the Sun Belt Conference. But the answer is the same clauses exist, but there are more ways to ensure that the money is there for a men's basketball coach than a women's basketball coach, and that's the realities of the TV markets, conference agreements, and a whole complex range of variables.
Other questions? All in favor of approval of the addendum number one, indicate by saying aye.
Madam Chair, I'd like to explain my vote.
Do I continue?
Yeah, you haven't voted yet, or he can explain in advance of the vote, or he can explain after the vote, whichever.
All right. We have ayes and opposed.
I say aye, but I want to explain my vote.
Hang in there. I know you're there.
Okay.
I haven't lost you. Any opposed, indicate by saying aye. It carries. Now, would you like to explain your aye?
Yeah, I really believe that the General Counsel needs to look. The Kentucky Arbitration Act exempts employment contracts from its provisions. Secondly, I think you'll find case law that an institution such as this cannot agree to enter into binding arbitration. And I've made this point before, but it's awkward because I have the utmost respect for Wood Selig and all these coaches and what they're getting. I'm for as much money as you can give them. And so it's an awkward spot, Madam Chair, but I wish it would get resolved. Thank you.
All right. You've heard his wish.
It's a state, you say state law?
There's a Kentucky Arbitration Act that exempts employment contracts from its provisions. It also exempts insurance contracts, just to give you an example. But more significantly than that, in other words, you couldn't enforce it because it's an employment contract under state law. But I think more significantly than that, a state institution such as this cannot delegate its sovereignty decision-making to an independent third-party arbitrator. And that's why I'm against those kind of provisions. But you've got them anyway.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you.
There's I won't say I understand all variables in what Larry's describing, but I do have some understanding of it. And I go back to Patty's most valid comments. You have to achieve a balance in order to achieve your objectives. And in the absence of a binding arbitration, you're not likely to sign many coaches to contracts. Is about the best way I can summarize that.
With respect to Delphi, too, if you put lawyers in a room together, you're going to get two different opinions from his team. I think I submitted those to our outside legal counsel. I think it is conclusion based contracts. I also feel like it's in the best interest of the institution and the coach, because it gives us an avenue to mediate disputes outside of the courtroom.
Well, mediation, I agree with. Binding arbitration is what I disagree with.
We also try to avoid dealing with agents, and we want to be careful not to get to a point where we're dealing. We simply have drawn a line, and we're not going to deal with a coach's agent. We just don't. It's a matter between the university and that individual employee. So there again, there's just a lot of variables that we have to try to accommodate in order to. achieve our objectives and make progress. And again, you're right, but we have to work within the market and the sphere of influence that goes into these kinds of negotiations, contracts, and decisions. So not debating you, but we got to do what we got to do. As long as it's deemed to be appropriate and legal, and so far so good.
May I ask who outside counsel is on this particular issue?
They're okay. Who we have on retainer.
Is Greg the one who's... Okay, thanks.
All right. Item 7.3.5. This is a motion to approve addendum number 1 to the second amended athletic employment contract between Western Kentucky University and Travis Hudson. Would you want to make any comment before I have someone make that motion?
Travis Hudson is... our head coach for women's volleyball, has been our head coach for 10-plus seasons, has had 100% graduation rate during his tenure here as head coach, 8 consecutive seasons of 20 or more wins, and helped us get an at-large bid for the first time in our league history to the NCAA tournament this year. Recently, several schools have tried to solicit his involvement in their search processes. He has resisted all temptations to get involved with any other search, which we've been very, very fortunate to have that loyalty. He's coming upon the conclusion of his current contract, a multi-year contract, and we want to extend loyalty back to Travis in exchange for the loyalty that he showed WKU Athletics. So he's interested in being here for a long time. He also wants to have a contract that, in the eyes of a potential recruit and a recruit's family, illustrates the commitment that the university has made to him as well as his commitment to WKU. So this contract illustrates the commitment that we would like to extend Coach Travis Hudson. While it goes through 2016, it's really a 4-year contract with 4 1-year options to maintain a consecutive 4-year agreement between WKU and Travis Hudson. But he can honestly tell a recruit that he has a contract that could keep him at WKU through 2016 the way it would automatically roll at the end of each year. So this illustrates our commitment to Travis Hudson and helps him recruit and maintain our volleyball program at a top 25 level that we have currently.
Entertain a motion for approval.
So moved.
Second. All right. Any questions or discussion?
I have a couple questions. Again, I've not seen a lot of athletic contracts, but is this type of long-term contract, I notice you have the language in here about KRS, says you can't create an employment term that exceeds 4 years. Is this competitive with market? Is this the normal type of thing we do? I have no objection to this, to be
right.
clear, but I just want to know what type of
right.
model we're using here.
We're trying to basically stay up with market demand. Football, men's and women's basketball, volleyball, baseball are coaches that are on multi-year contracts.
Okay.
When you look around the country at the Division I and specifically the Division I-A level, those are the coaches within those programs around the country that typically have multi-year contracts. And it's even gotten to the point where assistant coaches are getting multi-year contracts. We have not extended any assistant coaches a multi-year contract, but we do have 5 current head coaches with multi-year contracts.
This is a question on what you said about assistant coaches.
Right.
Does that hamper the head coach a little bit?
Excuse me?
Does that hamper the head coach a little bit? Say he decides they don't like him anymore.
Right, it will. It would involve a buyout. So that if the head coach was frustrated or wanted to make a change at that position, there would be a buyout involved.
I think we shoot ourselves in the foot with that kind of stuff.
Very well could be.
Second.
It also, though, a lot of assistant coaches move to become a head coach or another assistant job. It would involve a buyout to protect the university to replace that individual should that move occur.
And a lot of times they'll name them associate head coaches instead of assistants.
Right.
To help
right.
out with that.
Exactly. But Travis Hudson is just an extension of the contract. Doesn't change any terms or conditions of the current contract.
Any other comments or questions? Hearing none, all in favor of the motion indicate by saying aye.
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 I explained my vote the same way as before.
All right, so noted. That concludes the action items. I would like to call on Forrest Roberts to brief us on the information that she's put together. I think everyone has received a two-page information about how the evaluation of the president is conducted and other information surrounding that process. Forrest, would you share with us, please?
I've been chairing a committee made up by Jim Myers, LaDonna Rogers, and myself to look at the president's evaluation process and to make suggested changes. Just to give you a little bit of background, I've passed out a copies of the bylaws. We're trying to bring the process into compliance with the bylaws. We've also have looked at the guidelines that are recommended by the Association of Governing Boards. We also, Deborah also got for us the forms that are used by comparable universities. We've looked at those, so we've taken that, and that is what has brought us to this proposed policy. The bylaws specifically say that the president is to be evaluated in executive session at the annual meeting of the board according to written objectives, specific and general, developed by the president in conjunction with the board. So basically what we're doing now, in which everybody fills out a form, we send it to Lois, and then she compiles it into one, which is then given to the president, really is not in compliance with the bylaws. So what we're suggesting is we then meet annually as a board in executive session. We together fill out the form and then appoint a committee who then takes it to the president and discusses it with him. This not only would be in compliance with the bylaws, but it would also help make the chairman's job a lot easier, because Lois tells me trying to take 11 evaluation forms and compiling them into one is really very difficult and time-consuming, so it would be something that we would do as a group. As for it being done in accordance with written objectives, my thought on that, and I did not put this in the policy, and again, it's just a draft, but that the president would develop those objectives that would then be presented in the fall of the year, which would be in, sort of in halfway between the beginning of the school and the beginning of the fiscal year, and that the board would then agree or say, well, we think you also need to look at this or put this in an objective, whatever. And then that would be used to in the evaluation in the next spring. Again, we can tweak that or change that if necessary. The periodic comprehensive assessment, this is something that is recommended by the Association of Governing Boards. We made it discretionary. They advise that it's the best to do it maybe after a new president has been there every 5 years. Considering Gary and his tenure, I don't know if it's necessary for us to be doing that, but if we get a new president at some point, we might want to do that. But it is discretionary in the board, and it would be the board's decision whether or not to do that on a periodic basis. The board self-assessment, I think, was it 2 years ago we did the board self-assessment, and I think that was very helpful. I think the board also needs to look at itself, and was it last year?
It was last summer.
Was it just last year?
Time drags when you're not.
Anyway, I thought that was very helpful. I think it's something the board needs to do, is sort of look at itself periodically. And we set every 3 years for that, because then that would catch the term for the staff, the faculty representatives, that they would at least be a part of, since they have three-year terms, that would allow them to be a part of that. So what this is a draft, and I think Lois is going to ask for your recommendation. Let me make one more comment. We are not suggesting changes to the form that we're using. If you recall, we made adjustments to that last year. My thought was, when we get together and fill it out as a group, we may decide to do changes at that point. We may decide it does not work that well. I know Lois has some suggested changes to it, so I think if people have suggested changes to the form that we're using now, the committee will gladly take those under consideration and come back with any changes that we think might be necessary.
This is the sheet I'm talking about that you received. Mm-hmm. If you would write on there anything that you would suggest other than the way it's stated, and I'm going to get this, give it to Forrest, and when you get all those, that let's look at that, and then we're going to send it forward and have Dr. Ransdell and Deborah look at it as well, so that we make sure that we're... There's some questions I had. For example, you know, when does a year begin? Because right. Is it going to be the calendar year? Is it going to be the fiscal year? Or how are we going to... There's some little... They're minor things. And then there's some things that are perhaps, instead of saying that we should, we could say we may, which gives a little bit more of an option. But your input needs to happen now, because this is something we want to deal with in the near future, in the next week or two, not 6 months from now. So if you don't send anything forward, that means whatever. Whatever we do is fine. If you would do that and write it on here, then we will take those and work through it. And it's really not, I don't think, the time that we want to hammer it out here. But please be thoughtful. Put your name on it in case we need to come back and say, what did you mean by that? So I'm going to hand mine up. Would you pass that to Forrest, please?
Okay.
And get those to her, and let's have that within the next week so then we can move forward.
Madam Chair, I don't have the Open Meetings Law of Kentucky memorized, but I know the beginning of it says if something will lead to the appointment or dismissal, so on and so on. I'm not sure this really complies. An evaluation of a president...
The policy you're speaking
to? Yeah, I'm looking at the bylaw.
No, it complies. Personnel matters are exempt from open...
General personnel matters are not. I'm uncomfortable. I already got dung once by the Attorney General this year over a soccer coach. I'm not sure I agree that we could go into a closed session, that's an executive session, a closed session to discuss an evaluation. It's not going to lead to his appointment. He's got a contract, for goodness sake. It's not going to lead to his dismissal. It doesn't fit those parameters. We hope not. It doesn't fit those parameters, I don't think, off the top of my head, of the Kentucky Open Meetings or Open Meetings Law.
But I'll do.
As I understand it, we're not going to take any action today.
No, we're not.
I'd be happy to study that.
Okay.
I just want
to. We get this together, then we'll get with you. All right.
With all due respect to the Attorney General, I think he was dead wrong on that.
But but as you know, he is the authority.
Well, I realize that.
Yes.
But
on that issue, just like Stivers may be wrong.
I'm still saying I disagree with that opinion, and I think, and I won't take any more time doing that. But you know, so we'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
So okay. So if you would please, we would value, and if you'd write those things down, make sure they get to Forrest, and please. Note on your calendar, if you're going to respond within the next week, you need to do that. We would value you doing that. We put it in writing. That will be helpful.
You want me to email you? If people want me to email them a copy of this, and then you can do it electronically.
Would you do that?
You'd rather have that.
That'd be good.
Yeah, that's good. I'll do that. We'll have Liz, if you could do that, because you've got everybody's email address already. If you could email them. Email people.
Okay. With a reminder of, you know, to respond to that later then, please. Okay? Thank you, Forrest, for your work and on your committee. Thank you. All right. Informational things. Tom Hiles, campaign update.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Ransdell asked me to give a year-end report on our campaign. And first of all, some of you read our gift announcement yesterday in the Daily News from the Jarvies. We were very pleased to announce, if you didn't see it, $500,000 commitment from John and Jackie Jarvie. Jackie is from Adairville, Kentucky, and it's $500,000 gift. We matched to create $1 million endowment professorship to endow the honors director's position and also for support for the honors program. So we're very proud of that. That's the first matching gift chair professorship that we've announced in several years. So I'll talk about Bucks for Brains money in a minute, but I've got a brief presentation, Madam Chair, on our year-end numbers and then a quick analysis on where we are with the campaign. So with no further ado, please stop me if you have questions. We are now at about $103 million in overall endowment. As with most institutions around the country, this last quarter was rough. We are underwater since the last quarter results, and I will tell you just briefly that our investment subcommittee is looking at a whole wide range of issues right now of changing our investment philosophy and looking at a variety of methodologies that are used at national institutions like Yale and Stanford in the area of alternatives. We have studied this for over 3 or 4 years, and we feel comfortable with some of the changes we've made in our current investment policy, and so we feel we'll share more about that later if you have an interest or if you want to ask me questions. But suffice it to say, our investments committee and our WKU Foundation take it very seriously to try to achieve a goal of $200 million endowment by 2012, which is very daunting right now, but especially in the current marketplace. But we're very aggressively pursuing that. Next. Cash. This is something I'm very proud of. We'll be doing an announcement overall next week on a record-breaking total and in a very down year. Overall, and the economy affecting the campaign, up until about a month ago, I thought we were going to have a down year actually in cash, but we were able to achieve a slight increase of a little less than 1%. Next. Similarly, we were right up against it on President Circle growth, and we were able to achieve an increase in overall President Circle numbers, the individuals who give $1,000 or more annually. And as I've noted in the past, but just in case you didn't remember, when Dr. Ransell took office in 1998, we had about 400 President Circle members. So you can see incredible growth since that time. And really, that's the backbone of our whole development program. Next, I want to do a quick analysis for you year in now. We're in December of this year. We will be at the halfway point in the campaign. And so I wanted to give you a quick snapshot. The campaign numbers are very strong, and we're ahead of schedule for our campaign. I'm going to show you that in a minute. But we do have some daunting tasks, so I'm going to give you a little bit of the good news and the bad news. So first of all, on the campaign number overall, which is the next slide, you'll see that we're almost at $123 million on overall campaign. And so you can see where we've tracked that. There's nothing magic about 112, but that's what we projected we needed to be at June 30th. And Dr. Ransell alluded to this earlier, but we were at 91.1 when we announced in September, so we've seen an incredible $30 million worth of growth in gifts and pledges since that time, so we're very proud of that. And I'll talk about some of the reasons why that is occurring in a minute. Next. On the analysis side, people ask me about how this affects the campaign. It definitely does. And I will tell you, you know, we started our first campaign in 1998, and you all remember what happened in 2000 with the tech bubble and some of the things that occurred during that period of time. It was challenging. And what it causes donors to do is pause, and particularly when you're talking about legacy gifts of six and seven figures, it causes some reflection. And that has caused some folks to tell us they needed more time, tell us they wanted to wait till the market is better, tell us they've got to wait now and look at it in a year or two. But the good news, I'll tell you about later, is people are still making commitments. So let me talk about some of that good news right now. Major donors continue to support Dr. Ransell's vision. Big gifts come from big ideas. And that's what I doubled down on. I had actually Natalie over there asked me a while back from the Daily News, you know, with the budget cuts, you know, are donors responding and saying, hey, you need more support now that the state has cut your budget? And I said, you know, absolutely not. That's not what inspires donors. Donors are inspired by getting things done. They want to see if they make a commitment for something significant, whether it be a scholarship or support of faculty or otherwise, they want to see something done. And I think this is really critical, is that we have a lot of ideas. We have a lot of the concept of a leading American university inspires donors. And I think that's what's driving some of our success right now. Next. We've grown the pipeline of deferred gifts from 13 to 85 million, and that is critical. We have really marketed our Society of 1906. You read about the $7 million gift last week. That was in the form of a trust, and that's something that we work on with donors, whether it's a real estate gift, a charitable remainder trust, a lead trust, a straight-out bequest. All of our development officers understand that process and are out working that discussions. It doesn't cause a donor to give, but when you understand the tax ramification of a state law and some of the opportunities within charitable remainder trusts, where a gift that they would have had to sell for stocks that would have had to pay capital gains, you can instead flip into a trust and actually provide income to yourself and then later to the university, it makes a lot of sense. So these kinds of things has really bolstered our opportunities within the campaign. And as you see, we now have over 400 members of our society. These are documented estate gifts. Next, our staff and volunteers, we've been fortunate. A lot of universities around the country, when they go to a second campaign, lose their entire major gift staff and our annual fund staff. That has not happened here. We've had a few replacements. But a lot of the volunteer continuity is there. Don Vitale chaired the first campaign. He's chairing the second campaign also, co-chairing it. So we've been fortunate that way. And then I think there's one more. We have more than 60 proposals pending right now, totaling 8.7. You got to go out and ask. And that's part of our mindset, and we have been very proactive in doing that. Okay, on the more challenging side, we don't like to say bad news. We'll say challenges. We've experienced the first drop in the number of individual donors for the first time in 10 years. Individuals who are given $100, $250, with gas prices doubling and otherwise, some of them chose not to do that this year, and you can understand that. And we're doing all the same things we've done before and ratcheting it up, but we just did not get there with the number of individuals. Now, I will say the actual number of gifts actually increased because we had multiple givers throughout the year, but the actual individual donors, we had the first decrease this year. Secondly, we've increased our cash donations, but last year you saw we had a 21% increase. This year we barely edged over the 1%, so there's definitely a slowing of that cash increase. Next. This is a big challenge for all universities around the country. You have a very mobile alumni base. We got 90,000 addressable alumni, and they're moving, they're changing job titles. It's very expensive. Every year we have 3,000 new alumni that graduate, so we're trying to track them early on. It's more expensive to do our mailings. That's a big challenge for us, so we're out there using certain companies to help us stay in touch with them, do address updates. Our volunteers keep us updated, but this is a big challenge for us. And then finally, I want to talk about some next steps here. How do we address these challenges? Find new donors. I mean, that seems to be a pretty obvious one. But a couple of examples. Barbara and I have been talking about this a lot. International donors is a big growth area for us. And that's a real challenge also to find them. But we've been working with some organizations and a couple companies to help us identify and find good addresses on our international alumni. Parents Fund, I know Larry worked with us on that previously as a parent, and helping to identify and get information on parents of students. Next, utilize all matching and challenge gift opportunities. We now have $2.5 million from the state for matching money. We also have a couple of individuals who provided challenge gifts. That's very effective. We're going to announce several other new gifts with matching money soon with that $2.5 million. We haven't had a new professorship in several years. We had 28 of them in the first campaign, and that's a direct result of having matching money. We had about $12 million of matching money in the first campaign. We haven't had any for a while. We've gotten a couple of estate gifts, but nothing in cash, and matching money makes a critical difference. Expand the volunteer base and strategically use their help. You know, we were continually looking for individuals. I got a call today from somebody who said, you need to get this person involved. And when people get involved on one of our boards in other ways, they also give back their financial resources. And then finally, stay focused on the outcomes and describing the vision. Again, it's very critical. Our job is to translate that vision to donors so they understand what we're trying to achieve. It's not just because we need the funds. Everybody needs funds, but they want to see something done. And Dr. Ransom is very good. He gives us a lot of his time to be able to go out and one-on-one articulate that vision, and that is very important to our needs in going forward and being effective. And then lastly, as they say in business, you have to ask for the business. We do have to ask for support, and we're very proactive in that way. So those are a couple of things that I would touch on. I'm going to just stop there for a second, Jeff, and ask if there's any questions. I do want to show you a couple of results from the planning survey that we did, and then we'll wrap it up. Any questions on any of the campaign analysis at this point? I went through a lot in a short period of time. Okay, well, let me close by showing you some planning survey results and also our alumni efforts. We sent out a survey of about 5,000 surveys, got a 28% response rate, which is extremely high if you know anything about direct mail. And some of the highlights of that include the following. We'll go through these real quickly. There's a scroll down here. 75% said they were well informed about WKU. Next. 95% said they had a positive attitude about us. 86% a positive impression. And by the way, these are individuals. This isn't a random sample. These are individuals who we identified have the ability to give substantial gifts, either through publicly held assets or identified as previous donors. Next. When asked, this is a very critical question, you know, because it's great to know somebody has $10 million net worth, which they also share with us in this planning survey, but if we're way down their list, it really doesn't have that big an impact. So this was an important question we asked about where WKU fits in their overall giving interests. Next, almost 100% report making a gift to WKU said their gift was properly stewarded, which is important from us from a customer relations standpoint. And 8.7% said that we're in their estate plan, so we found out about almost 100, a few of these we knew, but there's almost about 75 new estate gifts that we didn't know previously. And then 26 respondents reported annual income of $250,000 or more. And the last one being 292 responded with net worths of $1 million or more. So this is very valuable information and goes back to that question of how do we find new donors to the institution. That's a part of our campaign process. And then our last slide, I won't share all those items, but those are examples that we're not just contacting our alumni when we're asking for support. There's a variety of ways and literally thousands of events we do every year with our alumni association that has an impact on institutional pride and getting people engaged and involved. And these are just a few examples of the last quarter of some of the alumni events that occurred during that time period. So it's more than I normally share with you, but I did want to give you a snapshot in a very difficult economic time why we're still optimistic. Some people say, well, you got to time your campaign so you don't hit a recession. That ain't going to happen. As Jim said the other day, he's been through a number of recessions. It occurs. We had one, and we had some real challenging times during our first campaign. But the key is that you've got to maintain the momentum. You've got to keep describing the positive vision and going out and asking. And we've been doing all the above. So we're pleased with the progress. We've got some challenges in the future. But I did want to give you a mid-campaign snapshot, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thanks for your work.
Okay.
Tom and his staff do terrific work. And the... I think the policy perspective for this board in this campaign is goes way beyond the dollars. The psychological impact of success in a capital campaign like this affects almost everything else across campus. It's a significant esprit de corps, morale, confidence boost for our faculty and staff and our students for that matter. They read, they see, they understand when people make investments like we're able to announce periodically. And they understand that it's the academic enterprise, for the most part, that is the beneficiary of this support. In round numbers, I'm guessing 75% of the gift to this campaign will be to academic programs. The rest will be athletic, student life, other kinds of things. Some brick and mortar, but it's mostly endowment. And it's the whole, all the things Tom describing, he described most of the science that goes into the raising of private support, but it's part art and part science. And it's about relationship building and confidence in the institution. As Tom described, so I think this board needs to continue to understand the residual value of success in this campaign that goes way beyond just the building of an endowment or the gifts that are received. And in the absence of it, it's just one of those important things that we point to that is a measure of our momentum and confidence as an institution. So I congratulate Tom and his staff for continuing a performance, and it's the momentum on which we build a lot of other things in addition to the dollars. So, good work.
Thank you.
Give an update on WKU athletics. I've got an additional book that summarizes our success this past year. Let the books roll around here.
They were rolling.
That may happen as well.
You said roll. I thought.
This is in addition to the information that's in your packet today. But this year has been an exceptional year for WKU athletics, and we felt like we couldn't let 07-08 totally close the books on that season without producing something about our championship effort this past season. So this booklet has been created, and we will utilize this booklet. We will send it to all of our donors. We'll send it to our corporate partners. We'll send it to individuals associated with WKU Athletics, because we feel like perhaps we haven't told our story in the past well enough, and we sure have a great story to tell. I'll walk you briefly through this booklet to point to some of the highlights, but you can take it with you, obviously, and look at it throughout the course of the summer. The first cover is a quote by Bruce Jenner talking about championship effort. And if there's one theme, one motto that we have within WKU Athletics, we want everyone to give a championship effort, whether it's the coach, the student athletes, our donors, our fans, to win championships. It takes a championship effort by everyone. On the page with Tyrell Hayden, the running back for WKU football, you can see WKU wins 10 conference championships. That's an all-time record for the Sun Belt Conference to have one institution win 10 league championships. WKU won 10. The previous record we had tied for was 7 back in 05-06. So we've extended that to 10 in 07-08. The chart that I really like, WKU wins 10 championships, and it compares every one of the 11 1A conferences with WKU and the Sun Belt Conference. WKU won 10 Sun Belt conferences. The next closest was BYU in the Mountain West. They won 9. Notre Dame in the Big East won 8. Texas A&M in the Big 8 won 8. And you can go on down the list to, you know, where ACC, Virginia won 6, SEC, Florida, and Georgia won 5. But no school in the country within a 1A conference won any more championships than WKU did in the Sun Belt with 10. And we think that's an exceptional accomplishment, specifically when we had 18 of our programs participate in the Sun Belt Conference. So 10 of our 18 sports won championships, or 55% of our sports came away with championships this past season. That is reflected on the Vuvuzela Cup page. If you'll turn the page to the Vuvuzela Cup, that's our goal annually for WKU Athletics, is to be the best overall intercollegiate athletic program in our conference, as defined by the number of championships and success that you have across the board within the league. And we won the Vic Vuvuzela Cup again this past year, 2007-2008. Academics will be the next page. WKU top Sweet 16 in graduation rate, with 100% graduation rate in the six-year period that they quantify the graduation rates. I think interesting is the grid on the bottom of that page. It talks about the schools who participated in the NCAA tournament this past year in 07-08, and it lists the schools and the graduation rate success that each of those schools had. WKU tops the list of all participants in the NCAA with 100%, followed by Butler, Notre Dame, Davidson, Purdue. You can go down the list. You can see the number of private schools that are in the mix.
WKU is one of just a handful of public institutions with the type of academic success compared to the others in the NCAA tournament. So we're definitely keeping some good company with Butler, Notre Dame, Davidson, Xavier, Vanderbilt, Stanford, and exceeding the success that they had academically on their men's basketball team. So we're very proud of our academic success. 87% of WKU student-athletes who fulfilled their eligibility this decade have graduated, which we feel really strongly about as a great accomplishment. It speaks to our coaches recruiting the right type of individuals who can come in and have the type of academic success that we want them to have while they're here at WKU. If you turn the page to world-class facilities, obviously it takes facilities to attract the best students, be it academic facilities, athletic facilities. Facilities recruit the best students in America and internationally. We feel like we're on track to have some of the best athletic facilities in the country, which will help us to recruit some of the best student-athletes in the country while also retaining our head coaches, but also it provides the fans and the spectators with a quality experience when they come out and come to Diddle Arena or come to the renovated Halton Smith Stadium or our Nick Dennis baseball field or a soccer or a track location. Facilities really attract and retain the best, and we feel like we're on track to have some of the best facilities in the country. Turning the page, believing in making history, the transition to the Football Bowl series, that's 1A. This year at 08, we will be a full-fledged 1A member. We will count as a 1A football program, and you'll note our schedule is a full-fledged 1A schedule. We are going to be playing Alabama, Virginia Tech, Indiana, Kentucky. It's going to be a great, great schedule. It's going to be absolutely challenging, but it'll be great exposure, great visibility for the institution, for our program, and we're excited about the challenges ahead. When you look on the very bottom of this page, it talks about 2007, we posted our 12th consecutive winning season. Just because we're going to have a very challenging schedule in 08 doesn't mean that we're not going to gun for a 13th consecutive winning season. That would be our goal. When you look at our football program academically, the APR for WKU football was 945. That was higher than every Sun Belt member institution and better by the average of all football programs by 14 points in 1A football. So we're getting it done academically within our football program, and we're having success.
Is that a typo, always emphasize? Should that be academics, always emphasizing academics? Is that
yes, good catch. Yes.
I think that's. I think
academics
what you want to say.
Yes.
Yeah, because you're talking about academics.
Yes, we will make that change.
Okay.
good.
We know you're emphasizing athletics.
Okay. Moving on. If you turn the page to Ty Rogers, everyone, I'm sure, if you didn't see it in person or live on TV, witnessed the shot by Ty Rogers. It gives you an idea of where the shot was aired on CBS, CBS Sports, ESPN. It's been on the YouTube. 125,000 have witnessed it on YouTube. Sunday night, it will air on ESPN as winning an ESPY in the category of best finishes, outpacing an NBA playoff, an NHL hockey playoff, and a race. A very, very close race finish. So great competition, won an ESPY on behalf of WKU, and then, of course, the $100,000 Pontiac scholarship to the general scholarship fund of WKU. That was a result of this shot as well that will be a great asset for WKU to award in the name of Ty Rogers to a student from the county where Ty Rogers is from. So that'll have a carryover, a residual in perpetuity with Ty Rogers and future students at WKU for years to come. A lot of people say, what was the value of the shot? What was the value of WKU's participation? We talked about it a little bit earlier. WKU advancing to the Sweet 16 generated $3.5 million to the Sun Belt Conference. With our revenue-sharing model within the league, about $450,000 of that $3.5 million will come directly to WKU Athletics as a result of our success. So there is a benefit of the success that we enjoyed in the NCAA. If you turn the page, national exposure, how is WKU Athletics performing on a national scale? What type of exposure are we bringing to WKU nationally? Look, the NCAA Student Athlete Advisory Committee, we have one of our track athletes, Patrick Jenkins, is just one of 31 individuals representing the Student Athlete Advisory Committee. That's kind of the leadership group of all student athletes in all of Division I. And every conference can nominate one student athlete to represent that conference. Our student athlete, Patrick Jenkins, is the representative of the Sun Belt nationally among all student athletes. We have the first and second rounds of the NCAA women's basketball here in Diddle Arena this March. If the Lady Toppers make the NCAA tournament, they're guaranteed to play right here in Bowling Green in Diddle Arena, first and second rounds this March. We received a grant for $36,000 to produce a book based on Mary Taylor Cowles about following your dreams. It's about a young girl growing up who wants to pursue basketball, a career in basketball, and it's basically the Mary Taylor Cowles story. And we're going to break that out to grades 3 through 5 throughout Bowling Green and Warren County and really have a unique and special program to grow basketball on the grassroots level, but also to tell the story about Mary Taylor Cowles. And the NCAA is sponsoring that with a $36,000 grant to produce 6,000 books that will be distributed to every third and fifth grader in Bowling Green and Warren County. And then our student athletes will go read the book in the classroom to all these students throughout Bowling Green and Warren County as part of this program. So a very unique grant that we received. We have been awarded the NCAA Regional Golf Championship in May of 2009 at Old Stone. We will have a handful of the best golf programs in America will be coming here to Old Stone to participate in the NCAA Regionals in May. And then, of course, Kenny Perry is on track with an outstanding year representing WKU extremely well on the PGA. Just yesterday, Sports Illustrated came out with its ranking of all 330 Division I intercollegiate athletic programs and ranked WKU 26th overall out of 330. Based on number of championships won in their conference, based on final NCAA rankings in that sport. Those were the primary criteria for that ranking. WKU ranked 26 out of 330, ahead of Louisville, ahead of Kentucky, ahead of Clemson, ahead of Alabama, ahead of Duke, ahead of Kansas. So we've had an exceptional year this year, and that's the type of national exposure that we're receiving. When you turn the page, celebrating championships, 10 of our programs won championships this year, and this page illustrates each of our 10 championship programs. You can see the flesh pile, as they call it, with baseball celebrating their championship, and then men's basketball, women's cross country, women's soccer, women's swimming, men's indoor track, women's indoor track, men's outdoor track, women's outdoor track. All those programs won championships this past year. An exceptional year all the way around. The individuals that make it possible, you can see the Courtney Lee on the top of the next page, drafted number 22 by the Orlando Magic. Will be a great representative of WKU in the NBA and provide years of positive visibility for WKU through the NBA and help us recruit future prospects to WKU as they see that they can come to WKU and realize their dream of playing in the NBA, just like Crystal Kelly with the WNBA. These are four of our standout student athletes, Megan Argybright, Meredith Goodson, Crystal Kelly, and Wes Brown. You can read about their accolades. And then some of our coaches. Eric Jenkins, I just want to make sure everyone realizes, Eric Jenkins was appointed our head track coach January 1. And he's led our indoor track and our outdoor track, both men and women, four programs to four championships. So as head coach, Eric Jenkins has not done anything but win championships for his career. He's never not finished in first place. So we have a great young head coach in Eric Jenkins. And then finally, back page by the numbers, counting down 12 to 1. You can see the 12 consecutive winning seasons in football, 11 consecutive years with at least one Sun Belt championship. 10 Sun Belt championships were the most in the conference history and the most by any 1A program in America. 9 Hilltopper teams with a cumulative GPA of 3.0 or better. 8 Sun Belt Conference Coach of the Year honors. 7 Sun Belt Conference Player of the Year honors. 6 programs with individuals qualifying for postseason NCAA. Those are like golf, track, programs where the team may not go, but individuals go to NCAA postseason. We've had 5 Bubas Cup All-Sports titles. Only 3 other schools in the history of the Sun Belt have done that. 4 programs teams that reached the NCAA tournament, 3 WKU student athletes, 1/2 of the Sun Belt Conference prestigious annual awards, 2 NCAA tournament wins getting us to the Sweet 16, and then 1 mission, which is the championship effort of our intercollegiate athletic program. And again, it would not be possible without the support of the board, without support of President Ransdale, without support of our donors, alumni, our students. We have great student attendance, but it all goes into producing a championship effort for WKU athletics. But an outstanding year. I didn't want it to go without proper recognition, so we put this book together so that everyone can have it.
Thank you, William. Thank you.
Most meetings you don't have an athletic report as part of the executive committee, but as we do with a lot of programs at the end of a year, you take stock of what kind of year you had, and it has been an incredible year in the classroom and on the court, field, school, whatever the case might be, for our athletic program, and we like the performance and how the university's brand is accelerated and strengthened through our athletic program. So,
well, I think
job.
That hill helps all that track and running people too. You know, they've had classes up there. Makes us have strong legs going up and down that hill, right?
That.
All right, the hill. Deborah.
Yeah. Thank you. I hope I get applause too. I told Larry I was going to sit by him so we could be point counterpoint. He's okay with that.
This is your report, not Larry's.
And I'm just going to hit some high points here, kind of give you a status. We didn't feel the need to go into closed session because most of what I'm going to tell you is public knowledge anyway or in the court record. But if you have any questions, just stop me, and if I can answer it here, I will. If not, I can catch you after the meeting. We have several cases pending now, and I always tell the Herald reporters, they'll call me and they'll say, well, when do you think this case will be resolved? And I said, maybe by the time you graduate, we'll have a decision. So we try to do a good job working with them and filling in their successors as they go through school. But they do take a lot of time to resolve these important cases. First one I'll update you on is the case of Ingrid Woods versus the university. Ms. Woods was employed in the Academic Advising and Retention Center. She applied for the position, the director's position now held by Ellen Bonaguro, and was not the chosen candidate. She has filed a suit alleging that she was denied the position based on her ethnicity, which is Hispanic. She claims that the job description has changed, and which resulted in her being not meeting the qualifications, and that it was changed in order to prevent her from being selected for the position. We feel like the case is very weak. We've completed discovery. The trial will begin on July 29th, week after next. The two decision makers, which are accused of the discriminatory acts, were the two who actually recruited Ms. Woods into her employment at the university originally. They promoted her. They supported her admission into the graduate and doctoral programs. And there's a strong presumption in employment law that a strong inference of non-discrimination where the person accused of the discrimination is the one who hired the victim. So we feel confident about that case. As I stated, it will commence July 29th, unless plaintiff's attorney requests another postponement, which he's done a couple of times. But as of today, it's still on.
Would you deny on summary judgment?
Actually, has been no ruling yet. We did file one. It's in state court, and as Mr. Zelke can back me up on this, very rare to get a summary judgment motion in state court these days. Thank you. And the next case, any questions on that one? The next case involves a scholar who was employed at the Institute for Combustion Sciences and Environmental Technology, what we call ICSET. That is Dr. Pan's research facility out in the ICC is what I call it, Center for Research and Development. Thank you. Ms. Zhang was employed there as a research associate. She was terminated for job performance reasons. She subsequently filed a discrimination complaint in state court alleging she was terminated on the basis of her gender and her pregnancy. She was pregnant at the time. Her shortcomings in employment are very well documented. The staff out there and her supervisor did an excellent job of documenting her performance shortcomings and working with her to address and improve those, and were not able to do so. But also, interestingly enough, her claim of discrimination is primarily directed at her supervisor, who just happens to also be female and to also have been pregnant at the time. So, again, we feel at this point very confident about this case as well. The discovery phase is just beginning. There's obviously no trial date, and none's to be set in the foreseeable future. But we'll keep you posted on those. Third case I'll update you on is an interesting one that's also been hanging around for a while. It's a young man who's a student up here, Patrick Ledbetter. He filed a civil suit against the university. He was exiting an elevator in Potter Hall. He uses a wheelchair. He is not confined to a wheelchair, but he suffers from back pain, and so he will use a wheelchair on campus. And he alleged he was exiting from the elevator in Cherry Hall, that it did not level properly, meaning the bottom of the elevator was somewhat above the floor, and that when he exited from the elevator, it caused his wheelchair to fall over and he hurt himself. There were no witnesses to the accident. We've had the case moved to the Kentucky Board of Claims because it is a claim of negligence against the university for failure to properly maintain the elevator. The Board of Claims, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is the agency established by statute in Frankfort to hear claims of negligence against state agencies. And so it's not strictly a courtroom setting. It's hearings are held before a hearing officer. And we did have that hearing. The hearing officer found no negligence on the part of the university. We were able to produce records that the elevator had been inspected as it is required to be inspected by law. That while there have been reports that it wasn't leveling, those had always been addressed immediately, and I think there was some feeling on her part that he should have been aware that the elevator hadn't leveled when he exited. But nevertheless, very strict evidentiary requirements before the Board of Claims, and he was not successful. He has since appealed that to the Warren Circuit Court, which he has the right to do, and it will not be a new hearing with new evidence. It will simply be oral arguments before the judge, and those will take place in November of this year. And we continue to feel confident that we'll prevail on that as well. The injuries he suffered were, he claims he has more back pain, and he had some injuries to his teeth, but was not able to produce any medical proof to that. So I think that was part of the weaknesses with his case. The third case is another one which has also been going on for some time, and that involves the estate of Melissa Kate Autry, the young woman who was a victim of a homicide in one of the residence halls. This case has been confusing, I know, to the media and perhaps to some on campus because it has taken several different tracks. There was case against the university, case against the individual student employees, and then a case against the Student Life Foundation. We have been able to get the university and the Student Life Foundation dismissed from the trial court cases on the basis of sovereign immunity. The case is now proceeding against the university in the Board of Claims. I've updated you all many times on this, so you know the university's position on this matter. We have not found any evidence that the staff on duty that night violated any policies or procedures that they had in place at the time. One of the difficulties of this case is that no one knows exactly how the perpetrator entered the residence hall, but it's clear that he did not enter it in compliance with our procedures for admitting guests or coming in to visit someone in a residence hall. This has been set for a hearing in the Board of Claims in late August, and we hope to bring this to closure as well. The student employees are being defended by the university, as we would with an employee who is performing their duties and acting within the scope of their employment. There is no action being taken at this time on a civil suit against them, which remains in place. And we feel like the estate is waiting to see the outcome of the Board of Claims action, and we have expectation that the claims against them individually will eventually be dismissed. But
the university's exposure in a matter before the Board of Claims in any given case is
$200,000, and that is paid from the state treasury.
So there is no financial exposure to the university in a Board of Claims ruling regardless of the decision.
Correct. It's like a self-insurance fund. Now, our exposure would be in future years. We pay an assessment to the, not an assessment, but it's not something like a premium to the state every year as part of this process. And I guess they could come back to us and say, you've had a hit, you need to pay more money. But
pay me now, pay me later, huh?
Mm-hmm. It's like a self-insurance fund for the state. Last is one which you have had a lot of information on recently, and that's the matter of the condemnation of the property owned by the Clark family. This matter is proceeding on two tracks, as similar to Autry. The first relates to the taking of the property, and as you know, if you've driven down Normal, the house is gone. We have demolished it to make way for the College of Education building. The court ruled that Western was entitled to take the property. We have posted the bond into court in order to proceed with that. They have appealed the taking, and we determined that we wanted to move forward with demolition. The appeal of the taking can take, Mr. Zeltin's pointed out to us, a considerable amount of time, and we feel confident that that decision will not be overturned on appeal. But the fact that the university had stated an interest sufficient to allow us to take that property. The second track relates to the value of the property. The commissioners have set the amount to be paid into court, which allowed us to move forward. We've done that. It has been paid to the Warren Circuit Court, and they're holding it, and it's accumulating interest. The matter will now be set for a jury trial to determine the value of the property, and both sides will be able to present information, but no trial date has been set as yet. Those are our major, what I call our major litigation cases that are going on right now. If hearing it from me, you may think, oh my gosh, we've got five cases. But in some cases, we feel like it's important to litigate accusations against the university and not proceed with settlement, and these are representative of those we feel strongly about. And also, I meet periodically with my counterparts across the state, and my perception is that our legal matters are much less and of much less significance than perhaps some of the matters so far.
As someone that sued UK, I agree with you.
If you look at this as a city of, say, 20,000 people, and you've got such little legal action, it's almost incredible what a great job you're doing.
Thank you. Well, and I want to take a moment to brag on the employees at the university, because your litigation is you're never going to avoid it. And one of my favorite questions is when someone says to me, how can I keep from being sued? You can't, unless you just want to stay home, stay in bed. And we can't do that. Our administrators do a good job of documenting personnel actions, and they make good decisions, and they consult with Tony or myself in employment matters, which is the largest of what we deal with. And we feel like we've got a pretty good track record. We try to resolve a lot of things before they get to the point of being a...
The academic, like these people that you mentioned that were promoted, whatever, do they have to follow an administrative procedure before they can have to exhaust it before they go to court? Or do you make them go to a faculty board and do all that type of thing? Because sometimes that's helpful.
We have a procedure for faculty promotions and tenure, but none of these have involved that. We've had those in the past, and they have gone through that track and still not satisfied still.
That's a grievance procedure in place that may or may not be exhausted before legal action.
No, you got to exhaust. That's my point. You got to exhaust administrative remedies before you go to court. That's why I asked the question.
Right. The particular cases that we're dealing with now, the application for a position that she didn't get does not have a grievance procedure, and the woman who was terminated, we don't allow a grievance procedure. Only because Tony and I personally review all terminations of employees on campus. Both of us look at all of them. He from the human resources policy perspective, and then myself from the legal policy perspective. And so we feel like we're pretty good gatekeepers in that regard. So we have a process, maybe not strictly a grievance process.
Long before Debbie's duties changed to also include chief of staff in my office, her perspective in her work as general counsel went through a significant change several years ago when we began to focus on the primary role of the general counsel is to guide the campus to prevent litigation and make smart decisions in the course of decision making, deal with matters sufficiently to the point where we can avoid litigation to the extent possible, knowing that there's always going to be something, rather than the role of the general counsel is to defend us. If we get to the point where we have to be defended, that typically falls to our law firm on retainer who handles actual defense in a court of law. So that shift has really paid off. And Jim, you're exactly right. When you consider 19,200 students, 2,100 employees, Tony, mostly young people, I continue to be pleased that the manner in which we manage what is a very limited scope of litigation is a good thing for us, and we got a pretty good track record of if we do have to find ourselves in court to handling matters in such a way that we've nearly always been successful. I mean, that may not always be the case, but we are a community of human beings, and there are flaws and things happen. Particularly when you're dealing with the complexity of facilities and the volume of access and egress in and out of buildings, and its weather and the volume of guests and visitors on our campus, from athletic events to theater and dance to lectures to visiting prospective students, on and on. It's a complex environment. And universities of our size, I shouldn't say this because it'll probably come back to haunt me, but universities of our size have a legal staff significantly greater than what you're looking at with our staff right
now. I have the smallest staff in the state. It's me. That's okay.
And do the best work, too.
Pardon?
Well, smallest
thank
staff
you.
Is
thank
best
you very
work.
Much. I get a lot of help from my colleagues, so I'm okay with that. You were talking about the safety of residence halls. There was an article in the Chronicle this week about a case that came down, I believe it was either Washington or Wisconsin University, where the police had been called to some sort of altercation in the residence hall, and they entered the floor, the hallway to the rooms, and arrested someone, and the court said that students have a privacy interest in the hallways outside their residence hall. Now, I haven't studied that in detail, I haven't seen the opinion, I just read the article. But it's one of these situations where, and the Autry case is a good example of it, we're darned if we do and darned if we don't. So we're trying to, and I know our housing people are trying to walk that fine line in ensuring student safety and employee safety, while still respecting the fact their privacy and the fact that they are adults, and they don't want a police officer or a residence hall director, you know, patrolling their rooms and knocking on the door and what's going on in there. So that's something I think all the universities are struggling with.
I think also you need to point out that sometimes it's a question of choosing your liabilities. Would you rather be liable for violating somebody's privacy for
exactly.
somebody getting hurt?
Exactly.
You know, which is
good point. Excellent point.
We have always erred on the violation of privacy as both of us.
That's always the way you should go.
Absolutely.
Keeping
and I think that's
safe.
Our philosophy.
Keeping them safe.
I'd rather be sued for notifying parents of a potentially dangerous or life-threatening situation involving their son or daughter and violating that student's privacy than to be sued by parents for failing to communicate or to intervene.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We follow that philosophy. If anybody has any questions afterwards that you'd rather ask me one-on-one, I'd be happy.
Applause. Thank you. All right. The media report, please.
Oh, no, he did it yesterday.
Are you off? So I am it. Okay. Then I'll be even quicker. The public learns about WKU through a variety of means, and one of those, as you all know, is the news media, and we cite that very often in our discussions with all of you. Just real quick, if Bob Skipper would stand, and I know you all know Bob, but just to point Bob out as the Director of Media Relations, and Tommy Newton is the Assistant Director. Tommy, please stand up as well. Yes, Bob has to, you have to. And also, she's not here today, but Amy Bingham DeCesare, and many of you know Amy from her days at WBKO. I think she spent about 16 years as an anchor there and now is working here with us in the media office. What does she do? She does The View from the Hill. You see that on Thursdays, and then we're working with her to also do some additional media, sort of media contacts. One of the things that we're trying to establish is where we are working as a point of contact. Bob, Tommy, and Amy are splitting up the campus and going out to departments, divisions, colleges with trying to learn of stories and interesting things that we should be publicizing on a little bit of a more proactive basis. Rather than sort of waiting to learn about them, we're going out and finding them. So included in your packet, what we've just provided for you all is a listing. We didn't do the whole stories. This is a year-end review, I guess, of some of the more significant stories. Many of them, of course, highlight Tom's successes in fundraising and a lot of the major gift announcements. You know, I think yesterday, and Tom, you pointed this out, the headline was another gift for WKU, and so it does get to be a bit more of a challenge. But all of the ones that are mentioned in here were big stories and had a unique aspect of the gift. A couple of those include the Grulich Endowed Chair in Robotics and Automation Engineering, the Fleshacre Green Fund for Excellence in First Amendment Issues, and also, of course, the Halchins L.T. Smith Stadium announcement. A couple of things I want to point out, actually, Wood and I were talking just a moment ago. On page 2, what says the Steve Eaton gift for Baseball Clubhouse, the Eaton gift was actually for basketball, and the Paul Orbison was the person who gave the gift for the baseball clubhouse. That was a $500,000 gift. So I just wanted to point out that those are in error in this report. A couple of other things I would highlight, the opening of the Cyber Defense Lab by U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell. That's a project that was funded through funding that he secured in the U.S. Senate that went to EWA, Electronic Warfare Associates, and we opened that lab this year and had a lot of good media coverage on that. Also a feature on the Kentucky Mesonet, something that will be of statewide interest as the Mesonet, which is a weather climate monitoring network, will pop up across the state in 100 locations. So that's also a funding secured by Senator McConnell. And then the announcement of the SkyTeach program, which is a partnership between WKU and the National Math and Science Initiative. There's only one state in Kentucky that received two of those grants, and Kentucky is one of them. WKU received one, the Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation received the other. So that's it's a quite an accomplishment, and that's a great program that Bruce Kessler and Sam Evans are partnering on between the College of Education and College of Science and Engineering. Also, the opening of the Gatton Academy of Mathematics and Science in Kentucky. Of course, all of you are aware of the successes of the Academy this year. The grand opening was quite an event, and we've had a number of stories related to the Gatton Academy, including a sort of a back-and-forth exchange with David Hopp from the Courier-Journal in the editorial pages, which all ended up very positive, but certainly has created a lot of attention. A couple of national opportunities, Popular Mechanics
ran a story on the void detection robot. We also had a visit, as I'm sure most of you remember because it was fairly recent, but from U.S. Senator Hillary Clinton in her presidential campaign. Also, and of course, Wood has more than gone over for you today the many successes in athletics over the course of this year, but particularly the NCAA coverage and the Ty Rogers winning shot. And one thing that I'm not sure, Wood, if it was in there, but there was also a feature in Tampa on Ed Stansberry, who, you know, is just a legend here, and also on the 100% graduation rate of our basketball players, which in the men's basketball program, which is another great accomplishment. We also routinely look to find members of our faculty who can serve as experts in speaking nationally or locally, regionally, statewide on issues. Scott Lasley, who is one of our political science professors, is one of those who's been extensively quoted throughout the presidential election, I'm sure, on statewide politics as well, as we have a number of significant elections this year, and also Mike May following the earthquake earlier. And then sometimes, well, unfortunately, we participate in news that's not so good and try to do the best we can to talk about particularly the WKU connections with Dr. John Minton, our you know, beloved former president and administrator of this university and just a great individual in this town, and also Joe Downing, who passed away earlier this year as well. So those are just a few highlights. It's a long list. There are lots of things that are not on this list. You will begin to notice, I hope, in the next few weeks, beginning in August, and as we move into the year, the ramping up of our advertising campaign. We've done some statewide media buy, which we do every year, but we're going to focus Owensboro, Louisville, Elizabethtown, Bowling Green, Louisville, Lexington, Northern Kentucky on Insight Cable, and so that's where the bulk of our advertising goes, and you'll be seeing a good bit of, I hope anyway, of WKU as you watch TV. So.
Thank you.
Barbara, just interesting to some board members may be a bit curious about Anthony Harkins with his moniker of hillbillies. That's a scholarly a publication on his part.
He's the scholar.
Yeah. Published a book, as I understand it, on hillbillies.
Yeah, and paperback, simultaneously published hardback paperback from Oxford University Press. He gets picked up, I think what you probably picked up this time. He's been consulted on from as diverse publications as the Boston Globe when the Paris Hilton show The Simple Life came on, and they sent her to Arkansas, and Tony was the person they called for comment, for background and commentary. But I think that reference this year came from he was extensively covered on Slate.com, which is a big national publication. So he gets a lot of play. Does TV spots.
Don't laugh.
Interesting niche. As you can see, Robin is well into her public affairs responsibilities as we've blended government relations and news and media relations into a public affairs division.
On page 70 in our board packet, we have recommendations for approval of personnel actions. And